This is Here and Now. I'm Lisa Mullins.
And I'm Jeremy Hobson. And the numbers keep climbing. More than 240,000 people in the U.S. have tested positive for COVID-19. More than a third of those are in New York, where hospitals have been overwhelmed. But as dense urban areas in New Jersey, California, and other states struggle to manage the virus, let's check in now on a state that is facing a very different challenge. We're joined from Kansas by that state's Governor Laura Kelly. Governor, thank you for being here. And Kansas has just over 500 confirmed cases. Very few people have died compared to other states. But experts are predicting that caseload will keep going up and peak near the end of this month. Are you going to have the capacity to take care of everyone?
Well, if Kansans do what they need to do, we will have the capacity. We've done some modeling. And if we can sort of reduce the movement of folks, which was the purpose of our stay-home order and purpose of shutting down our school buildings, if we can get Kansans to cooperate and stay home, and we can increase reduction in movement, the projections that we've done show that we will have enough ICU beds, enough ventilators to handle the caseload. If they don't, then we will need to make other arrangements, which we are already making, you know, looking to expand our capacity in case we don't reach that goal.
Now, you instituted that stay-at-home order on Monday. That's when it started. But most of your next-door neighbors have not done that. Missouri, Nebraska, Oklahoma only have partial stay-at-home orders or none at all. Is your order effective if neighboring states aren't doing the same thing?
Well, I think it would be more effective if everybody would just go this way. We deal with emergencies on a regular basis out here in the Plains States. We have wildfires, for instance, and trust me, I know they know no border. You know, they can start in Oklahoma and come right up into Kansas. We share borders, and disasters tend not to respect borders. And neither will this virus. So, yeah, it would be very, very helpful if everybody just goes ahead and puts the stay-at-home order in place.
Governor, I want to ask you about something that the president's son-in-law and senior advisor Jared Kushner said in the White House daily briefing yesterday. Listen to this.
And the notion of the federal stockpile was it's supposed to be our stockpile. It's not supposed to be state stockpiles that they then use. So we're encouraging the states to make sure that they're assessing the needs. They're getting the data from their local situations and then trying to fill it with the supplies that we've given them.
Governor, as the governor of a state, what's your reaction to those comments that the federal stockpile is not meant for the states?
Well, that's exactly what it's meant for. And it always has been and has to continue to be. You know, actually, Kansas has put in a request for hundreds of thousands of masks, swabs, and testing kits, and all of those kinds of things. We have received word that the orders were approved and filled, but we haven't seen the shipment. So the federal government absolutely has a responsibility to gather that stuff together and then to distribute it. I think part of the biggest problem was that when it was evident that this was going to be an issue months and months ago, that should have been the time that the feds were stockpiling all of the equipment and the testing and everything else we knew we were going to need. They didn't do that. They got a very late start, and we're all paying the price for that right now. So I would dismiss what Mr. Kushner said. That is absolutely not the way that it is supposed to work.
Are you having regular conversations with the White House about what you need?
You know, the National Governors Association sponsors a call once a week. There is a White House call, usually with the president and the vice president, and then Fauci and a few others from health or defense or whoever. And I participate in those calls, but I have found that the best way for me to deal directly with these issues is to go through my federal congressional delegation, Senator Moran, Senator Roberts, because they've got, you know, channels to the folks that need to be alerted to what Kansas needs. So I'm tending to go that way versus, you know, asking on the phone call to the White House. I just think for Kansas, it's a more effective way to deal with it.
I want to ask you one more question. The last time we talked with you, it was about the fact that you had reached a deal with Republican lawmakers to expand Medicaid in Kansas. Do you expect that a lot more people are going to need that now with the economic situation?
Oh, absolutely. You know, I mean, the reality is if we were to expand Medicaid tomorrow, you know, we wouldn't be able to implement that until 2021 at some point. But the fallout from this coronavirus long term is going to be severe and lengthy. And so, yes, absolutely, there will be a number of people who are going to need access to health care. It also would bring down another $1 billion every year from the federal government, which we are going to need because our health care system is taking a huge hit. We could have used the money before. We're going to need it even more as we go forward.
That is Kansas Governor Laura Kelly. Governor, thank you so much, and good luck with all these challenges ahead of you.
Appreciate that, Jeremy. You take care.
Today, there's more evidence that the coronavirus is taking a severe toll on the economy. The unemployment rate rose sharply, nearly a full percentage point, to 4.4%. Employers shed more than 700,000 jobs in the past month, and it is expected to get much worse. Joining us is Beth Fooey, senior politics editor for NBC and MSNBC. Hi, Beth.
Hey, Lisa.
The jobless numbers point to the pain people are feeling around the country because of the coronavirus. You follow politics, so how concerned does the president seem to be about not just the vast population of the unemployed, but how the jobless figures might affect the election in November?
Well, I mean, let's face it, the entire scope of this presidential campaign has been vastly changed by what we're seeing as the result of this pandemic. And I think President Trump has realized reluctantly, but nonetheless has embraced the fact that nothing else matters other than his performance through this crisis. And he will only be evaluated by how he confronts it and how he helps march the United States out of this crisis. And we're at a very early stage of this right now. He, of course, is watching the politics of this, but the politics of this go just right up into his performance as president. There's really nothing he can do. He can't campaign. He can't hold rallies. He can't change the subject. All of the things that he's so expert at simply are not going to apply in this case. So it's going to be his steering of this situation and his leadership that is ultimately going to determine whether he gets reelected or not.
The president is touting having been quick to shut down air travel into the United States from China as the coronavirus spread, but 2 months in, the administration is struggling to get critical medical supplies to states that need them most. We just heard from Kansas governor. How is the president dealing with complaints he's getting from various governors around the country whose hospitals don't have the supplies they need?
Well, President Trump is doing something that he's done many times in the past, which is to say that he wants to be appreciated for all the good he's doing, but doesn't want to take any responsibility for anything that goes bad. We're seeing that in this case as well. But in this case, it's real world consequences. If these governors don't get these supplies into their states, people will die. First responders will die or get very ill. Doctors will not be able to perform their tasks that are essential to getting through the health crisis that we are facing. President Trump does not want to be held accountable in any way for any lack of needed supplies, and so he's pushing back on these demands. You played that soundbite from Jared Kushner beforehand, where he basically reiterated the president's claim that it is not up to the federal government to equip states with what they need. Obviously, that is not how governors see it. The governor of my state, Andrew Cuomo, says every day it's putting governors in a position where they are competing against each other for needed supplies, driving the prices up. That's why so many people at the federal and at the state level are calling for a more unified national response to this, where states can come together, where the federal government manages the process. But to this point, President Trump has shown reluctance to that.
I want to talk about Democratic presidential candidate Joe Biden right now. On MSNBC this week, he was talking about the president's performance in this pandemic.
There are certain things that could be done now, should have been done a week ago, 3 weeks ago, a month ago. The test for me is, what does he do from this point on? And he has significant responsibility. Put somebody in charge. This is a war. You need a general.
Biden's criticized the rollout of the $2 trillion relief program amid reports that some Americans who don't have direct deposit won't receive relief checks until mid-August. What are you hearing about that?
Well, it's interesting. Vice President Biden is in a sort of awkward, very awkward position right now because he is at this point the presumed nominee of the Democratic Party. He should be the sort of the standard bearer for the Democratic response or voice around this crisis, but he really can't be. He's not the governor of a state. He doesn't have the kind of platform that governors have to speak out and to draw attention to what their states need. So he's instead sort of left to speak from his home in Wilmington, Delaware, and say what he thinks ought to be happening and what he would do as president. But there's very little for him to do to sort of illustrate that in a real world way. He's done much better in the last week or so, making himself available and doing interviews and speaking out and speaking to the press. But he's in this very odd position, really probably never before seen for a presidential contender, to have so little of a platform to stand upon to address something of this magnitude.
Beth Fooey, senior politics editor for NBC and MSNBC as well. Thank you, Beth.
Thanks for having me.
This message comes from Here and Now sponsor, Indeed. When it comes to hiring, you don't have time to waste. You need help getting to your short list of qualified candidates fast. That's why you need Indeed.com. Post a job in minutes, set up screener questions, then zero in on qualified candidates using an intuitive online dashboard. And when you need to hire fast, accelerate your results with sponsored jobs. New users can try for free at Indeed.com/here now. Terms, conditions, and quality standards apply. Offer valid through March 31st, 2020.
Next month marks 50 years since an anti-war protest at Kent State University in Ohio turned lethal. It started after President Nixon announced he was expanding the Vietnam War. Students planned a demonstration that day, and the governor sent in the National Guard to break it up. That sound from WKSU. The students did not leave. They were unarmed. They hurled rocks, and soldiers opened fire. Four students were killed, a number of others injured, in what's known as the Kent State Massacre. Robert Giles was managing editor of the Akron Beacon Journal back then. He is the author of the book When Truth Mattered, The Kent State Shootings 50 Years Later, published this week. Robert Giles, welcome to Here and Now.
Thank you, Lisa. Nice to be with you.
The Kent State shootings happened during a time when there were more than 9,000 protests from August of 1969 to August of 1970. The protests were about the Vietnam War. More than 50,000 young Americans had died in the war by that time. Kent State, though, was the only campus where students protesting lost their lives. You, as we said, were the managing editor of the local newspaper. You were put in charge by the big boss who was out of the country. He said to you, "Don't screw up," not knowing that something as monumental as this would happen. Can you tell us why this particular story in your long career has stood out and kind of haunted your memory since those days?
Well, Kent State was a national tragedy. The students were protesting the Vietnam War, and particularly President Nixon's decision to send U.S. troops into Cambodia. In those days, people trusted their newspapers. They trusted their newspapers to give them the best available version of the truth. And we had been covering demonstrations at the Kent State campus for a long time. We were very well prepared, and we worked under great pressure, and it gave the public a truthful account. And when truth mattered is a powerful reminder of why truth did matter, in my view.
Part of the issue here is that there were different versions of what happened in different newspapers, and your newspaper, the Akron Beacon Journal, happened to have the story correctly in the first newspapers that you put out, whereas the big newspapers around did not have it correctly. What were the differences?
The difference was that we were well prepared. We had a young journalism student who had just graduated and joined our staff and who knew the layout of Taylor Hall, which is the big building where the shooting took place. And he found that he went into the dean's office and he found Margaret Brown. she said, "Can I use your telephone?"
She was the secretary there.
She was the secretary, and she held the phone. She said, "Will you hold the phone for me?" And so she said, "Okay, I'll do that." And then this young student, and now our reporter, Jeff Salat, at the moment of the shooting, Jeff came in and began to report over the open telephone line to our newsroom in Akron. And by the time our last edition went to press, we had all the names of the dead and the wounded and a complete explanation of what had happened.
So you're attributing that to the fact that you had a reporter who knew the campus very well, who knew the people there well enough to be able to get the story. When some of the large newspapers were reporting that, for instance, two students had died and two National Guardsmen had died, that was not correct. You had correctly that it was four students who died. When that news came out, I mean, these are people who, when they hear that both students and National Guardsmen died, this is part of the national tragedy. I mean, this is an enormous story. And so I know you wanted to make sure that you got it right.
Yeah, the reason that there was this conflict was that the UPI had a reporter who overheard a telephone conversation on the guard's telephone that said, "We've got two dead here." And he assumed the two dead were guardsmen. And it was very troubling to us because we knew that it would feed into the impression by many opponents of the students and so on that the riot and the shooting was, in fact, started by the students. So we had our own reporter's eyewitness account, and pretty soon the correction was made by UPI, and that truth that there were four students killed held up.
Who was it who asserted at one point in the aftermath of this that one of the students was acting as a sniper and that's what set off the fire from the National Guardsmen?
That came right from the guard commander. And the guard kept using that, trying to make the case that the students, the protesters, were to blame. One of the reasons that that version was used was that next to the shooting site was a metal sculpture, and there was a bullet hole in the sculpture. So we got a piece of metal, we got the sculptor to come up with us and a marksman, and we did some test shots, and it actually proved the reverse, that the hole was made by a bullet that came from the direction of where the guardsmen work. And we published that story, and that has pretty well diffused the sniper argument. It kind of went away.
So let me ask you this then. You call the book When Truth Mattered, the Kent State shootings 50 years later. Truth, I'm sure you'd agree, still matters now. But what's the relevance to what happened then to now?
Well, there's a public hunger for truth today. There was then. And the focus is really on getting accurate information and trust. It's so much more critical than ever. And if you think about the truthful story that we're trying to dig out today, the best reporting comes from people, reporters who are relying on the experts. Well, that was true back in 1970 as well. That really cuts through those who want to talk about conspiracy theories and other things that simply don't hold up to the light of day. So there's a parallel there that I think holds up from 1970 to 2020.
Robert Giles was the managing editor of the Akron Beacon Journal back during the Kent State shootings. He is the author of the book When Truth Mattered, the Kent State shootings 50 years later. Thank you so much for speaking with us.
Good luck, and thank you, and good luck to you and your listeners. Stay safe.
In Italy, there's more bad news and a glimmer of hope. The number of coronavirus deaths is now nearing 14,000, but the rate of new infections is rising more slowly every day. The term plateau is being used a lot. But authorities are desperate for people not to let their guard down. Here and Now's Anna Benstead has this postcard from the Tuscan town of Fiesole.
Looking out over the Tuscan countryside, the hills are verdant with olive groves and cypress trees. The sun has teased out the wild violets, and pink anemones add a touch of colour to grassy meadows. One would think a chapter from under the Tuscan sun was about to unfold. So it's hard to read the words of the mayor of this small Tuscan town on her Facebook page. Sono veramente molto arrabbiata. I am really very angry, she writes. Mayor Anna Ravoni is truly annoyed because she has seen too many people outside ignoring lockdown orders to stay indoors. 2 months ago, you could have bumped into Anna Ravoni here in Fiesole and her welcoming smile would have brightened your day. So her angry tone is striking. But on the whole, the citizens of Fiesole support her. They want the mayor and the local police to give out more of the large fines that can now be placed on those who break the restriction rules, fines of up to 3,000 euros. One commenter on her page, though, has a more old-school approach. I invite my fellow citizens to throw water from our terraces and windows on those who have no respect for those who've already died from coronavirus. Other mayors across Italy have been posting even more impassioned videos with instructions to their citizens.
Di casa, da casa non deve uscire nessuno. E a Messina non esce nessuno perché c'è un'ordinanza.
Dovete stare a casa. Siete degli irresponsabili.
Se una viene in casa tua, se una viene in casa tua ed è venuta in casa mia, è venuta in casa di un'altra a fare i capelli a un'altra.
Quanto la spesa si dovrebbe fare? Una volta ogni 10 giorni.
These calls to obey the rules and stare a casa, stay home, do seem to be working, despite the blips on sunny days and some of the irritation on display. Italians seem to be surprising even themselves with how much they're sticking to the restrictions of lockdown life. From my housebound state, as I lean out of the window, I hear and see very little movement. In fact, one of the loudest sounds is in the afternoon when a van drives by with a loudspeaker on top, reminding everyone to stay inside. The big excitement in our house was when I went online and managed to score a home delivery of groceries. On the assigned day, I waited at the front door with my protective gloves on as the little truck made its way up the lane. The delivery man was remarkably cheerful, and together we worked out something of a dance routine so he could bring the groceries in without either of us getting too near each other. Here in central Italy, the disease hasn't been as heart-wrenchingly devastating as in the north of the country. And the example of the north probably explains why so many people here are following the guidelines and are infuriated when a few people don't. On the last day of March, Anna Ravoni and every mayor in Italy stood for a minute of silence in front of their town halls, with the flags at half-staff and the bells tolling to remember those who'd already died from coronavirus. For Here and Now, I'm Anna Benstead in Fiesole, Italy.
With this morning's March jobs report from the Labor Department, it is now official. 10 years of job growth in the United States have come to an end. The unemployment rate jumped to 4.4%, but remember that number is also including the first half of March when much of the economy was still functioning. Let's bring in Mike Regan, senior editor for Bloomberg News. Mike, 4.4% is already high compared to what we've been seeing, but isn't this expected to go much higher?
Yeah, absolutely, Jeremy. And you sort of hit the nail on the head there by pointing out that these surveys were done by the first half of March. They don't reflect the massive number of job cuts in the second half of the month. So if you look at some of the estimates from, say, Goldman Sachs and other Wall Street firms, their economists are looking at something like 20 million jobs being lost by July. That would push the unemployment rate into sort of the mid-teens percentages. I would say, though, I think all these estimates are kind of spitball estimates, to use the technical term. But undoubtedly, we're looking at an unemployment rate that's going to ultimately peak at a much, much higher level than this.
Now, the government did just pass that $2 trillion economic relief package, the largest relief bill ever. Is that likely, once it starts to make its way into the economy, is that likely to help keep unemployment lower in the coming months than it would otherwise be?
Yeah, that's certainly the goal. And there are incentives built into the programs that sort of require companies to keep people, as many as they can, on their payrolls. I would say there is another element of the stimulus that is causing a lot of questions, and that's that extra $600 a week in assistance for people who file unemployment claims. So obviously that's going to help those people a lot. For a lot of low-wage workers, though, that means they're going to be making more on unemployment than they did in their job. So there's questions about the effects of that, including will it keep the unemployment rate a little bit higher than it might otherwise be?
Another part of that $2 trillion relief package involves loans to small businesses. The White House chief economic advisor Larry Kudlow was on Fox News today saying that that part of the package is ready to go today. Listen.
I think the resources and the execution are going to be very good. So let's wait and see. I think the bankers are ready to play, and I know that folks need the help.
So the White House is confident about this loan program, but how complicated will it be to get the money out on such a large scale quickly?
Well, so the way this program works is that the banks make the loans to small businesses, but the government is actually guaranteeing the loans. In other words, if the borrower doesn't pay back the money, then the banks aren't on the hook. The government is. And there has been some complaints from a variety of different angles about this program. For one thing, the banks complained that they hadn't gotten enough guidelines from the Small Business Administration until just a few hours before the start of the program. So the very first day of it might not be going as smoothly as hoped. We'll have to wait and see, in the coming weeks how efficiently that money is delivered. But I agree with you. It's a gargantuan task for the government and the banks to undertake. And remember, they're also dealing with all the disruptions to their own workforces that the mm-hmm. rest of the economy is. So it's a difficult situation.
Difficult situation. And the relief so far seems to be aimed at a short-term issue, and some economists are starting to think this could go on longer than we think right now. Mike Regan, senior editor for Bloomberg News, thank you.
Thank you.
Stress on people on the front lines of the coronavirus pandemic just keeps growing. Now it includes the fear of losing your job. Even as cases surge, some healthcare workers, paradoxically, are facing layoffs, benefit cuts, and less pay. Martha Biebinger of WBUR in Boston explains.
Just 3 weeks ago, Dr. Catherine Davis worried about the coronavirus, but not about how it might impact her group of five OBGYNs who practice at a suburban hospital outside Boston. She subscribed to the conventional wisdom that medicine is relatively immune from the economy.
People always have healthcare needs. People get sick. People need doctors. People need medicine. And those needs don't really change.
Then 2 weeks ago, she watched her practice revenue drop 50% almost overnight after Massachusetts told doctors and hospitals to stop performing elective procedures, things like pap smears and mammograms. Last week, Davis and her partners gave their staff of 35 nurses, medical assistants, and secretaries two options: move from full-time to part-time, or agree to be laid off so they could collect unemployment. Davis herself is taking a 50% salary cut. She's still reeling from all of the changes.
I mean, it was in a matter of a couple of days that I realized just how serious this was and just how much it was going to impact every single aspect of my life. It was shocking.
The loss of revenue from routine and non-urgent care is wreaking havoc across Massachusetts. Atrius Healthcare, which serves 745,000 patients, is temporarily closing offices, placing many non-clinical employees on furlough, and withholding some pay for those who remain. Dr. Steve Strongwater is the CEO.
What we were trying to do is piece together a solution to get through the crisis and keep employed as many people as we can.
Congress just approved an economic relief package that includes $100 billion for the medical industry. Strongwater says physician practices like his must get their fair share, but hospitals are also looking for help with their own financial wounds. In Massachusetts, the State Hospital Association says its members are losing $1 billion a month because elective surgeries like knee replacements are on hold.
These are very uncertain times.
That's Kate Walsh, CEO of Boston Medical Center. That hospital is laying off 10% of its workforce, which is about 700 people. Walsh says workers who do direct patient care are exempt.
The first thing we tried to do was reassign people, redeploy people, and very reluctantly, and it's a very difficult situation, we agreed to furlough people.
Massachusetts isn't alone. Dallas-based Steward Healthcare is rolling out furloughs. Hospitals in Minnesota are reducing staff hours, and hospitals in New Jersey are considering layoffs for non-clinical employees. While it's clear hospitals are losing money, at least temporarily, Dr. Karkorali Krishnamurthy says employers need to think more carefully about the ethics of pay cuts and layoffs. Dr. Krishnamurthy is a neurologist who studies medical ethics.
When they're calling upon doctors and nurses to do more, this is not the time to be making it more difficult for them to do that.
There may be temporary employment options for clinicians who've been laid off. If they're willing, they might be able to work in field hospitals states are erecting quickly or special units opening to help with the surge of COVID-19 patients. But a lot of those jobs haven't started yet, and it's unclear if that will be enough to solve this strange problem of healthcare workers losing jobs and money during a massive medical crisis. For Here and Now, I'm Martha Biebinger.
Well, scientists around the world are working to find a cure or treatment for COVID-19. And here in the United States, researchers are hoping to speed up that effort with the help of supercomputers made available through a partnership with the White House, the Department of Energy, and a consortium of businesses led by IBM. For more, we're joined by Paul DeBar, Undersecretary for Science at the U.S. Department of Energy. Paul, welcome back.
Hey, Jeremy. Great to talk again.
Well, and you're calling this new group the High Performance Computing Consortium. What exactly do these supercomputers do, and how are you hoping that they're going to discover treatments or help discover treatments for COVID-19?
Yeah, great. So supercomputers have been used for decades for discovery science on many different things, and we've built them and others. IBM has built them for the private sector and academic institutions. For discovery, and the four major items that we use them on for science are materials, chemistry, biology, and physics to do different modeling, different simulation, different design at the most complex end. This is capacity that the American people have built at the national labs that we run, and also the private sector has built. And so using that capacity to go attack, obviously, a very important public health crisis is something that we're basically ready to do because we've been doing similar versions of discovery of around these topics for decades.
And are you expecting that this will help develop practical solutions, or is it more just about learning fundamental things about the virus itself?
Oh, no, we're very much focused on practical items right now. We and the rest of the members of this consortium are shifting tremendous amounts of resources of people, researchers, and also hardware towards practical solutions, in particular, trying to narrow down vaccines and therapies that should be focused on in trials that would have the highest probability. Obviously, at the end of the day, there's lots of actions being taken around the country to minimize the spread. But to a very large degree, science around vaccines and therapies need to be the ultimate goal here to really address the situation.
How soon do you think you'll have results?
Well, science is always something that's hard to exactly predict. But this computing is actually to narrow that window. You know, historically, as we would try to find a new material, a new piece of chemistry, or in this case, a new piece of biology and a biotech drug, you know, many times it can take years and years to kind of narrow it down. And this consortium is really an unprecedented number of not only government and academia, but the private sector, who's never done this before in the tech community, to focus all the resources to narrow that down. And a lot of predictions, obviously, for vaccines are 12 to 18 months. And we're just trying to maximize that opportunity of that happening.
Because you have the private sector involved with this, who owns the intellectual property that comes out of this research? If you do discover a treatment or a cure with this government research, will it be publicly available and affordable?
Yeah. So at the end of the day, what the consortium is doing is people are volunteering their capacity, both from a support point of view as well as from a hardware point of view, to do this modeling and simulation to drive towards solutions. This is going to be open science. The people who we're giving access to utilize the capacity that the, as of right now, 32 members of the consortium have put together will be the traditional way. I mean, obviously, the researchers are the ones who are going to be developing the actual ideas, whether they come from academia or the private sector or the national labs. And the very traditional way that IP is run will be done that way, i.e. the researchers and the researching organizations will do it. At the end of the day, I don't think we're particularly worried about any differences and changes in intellectual property. I think everyone's very much focused on really volunteering for free all this capacity to try to drive solutions.
Just one more thing. As we're all dealing with coronavirus, a lot of people are working from home. They don't want to go into the office because they don't want to contaminate it or get coronavirus themselves. Do you have a logistical challenge in having these supercomputers everywhere? Do people have to actually go in to do this work, or can they do it remotely?
Yeah, so a lot of the researchers can do this remotely. A lot of this is about data on small molecules, targeting COVID, and how to build up the algorithms associated with it. There is at any one of the institutions, so not only the DOE, 17 national labs, but Amazon, Microsoft, obviously IBM, who's a leader in this, all have supercomputers also all around the country. There is a minimal amount of people required to keep the computers up and running. But in the big scheme of things, most of this can be done with relatively minimal number of people on the ground to maintain the hardware.
That is Paul DeBar, who's Undersecretary for Science at the U.S. Department of Energy. Paul, thank you for joining us again, and good luck with this. I hope you yield some results very quickly.
Thank you, and appreciate everyone's support for this capacity that we have.
Governors are imploring Washington, D.C. to send medical supplies to help them deal with the coronavirus. Here's New Jersey Governor Phil Murphy on NPR this morning.
We've gotten some out of the federal stockpile in terms of ventilators and personal protective equipment, but not nearly as much as we need.
So how is what's left in the national stockpile getting allocated? Tolu Olorunipa is White House reporter with the Washington Post. Tolu, the president says the supply of protective gear, including masks and gloves, is nearly depleted. And FEMA says 10,000 ventilators left in the stockpile are now a strategic national asset. So what does that mean for states that immediately need these supplies?
Well, it means they're going to have to go without a lot of these materials. Now, the federal government says that they are buying much more of this equipment and shipping it directly to the states, but that still leaves a shortfall for a number of these states who say that without the critical ventilators and personal protective equipment, that they will not be able to care for the surge in patients that they're expected to see over the next few weeks. The federal government just doesn't have enough.
But New York, these hospitals and states are being pushed to the limit. New York says it will run out of ventilators in 6 days. The city of New Orleans and that region says it's going to run out of ventilators and hospital beds this weekend. We heard from the health department director in New Orleans, who says the governor requested 13,000 ventilators and got 192. On the other hand, we hear about, in your report, Oklahoma requested 16,000 face shields and got many times more than that, 120,000. What explains the difference?
FEMA and the Trump administration have not been able to explain that difference. They say they have a formula that's based on population, that's based on the needs of the various states, and that they provide a good chunk of what's in the stockpile based on those factors. But that has not been a satisfactory answer for a number of these states that are calling for a lot more of this product to go to their states because they mention how much of a great need they have.
Let's go to a comment that President Trump has made. He has repeatedly berated some governors for not doing enough, for being rude to him, for not being grateful enough for federal help. This is what he said last week.
The governors have been very gracious for the most part, I would say. A couple that aren't appreciative of the incredible job. They have to do a better job themselves. That's part of the problem.
Tolu, how much have you been able to ascertain that playing politics here is part of the problem?
Well, President Trump said it himself. He is inclined to not really help these states. He's saying that these states should be able to do this on their own. But at the same time, he does have close relationships with a number of these governors. And some state officials, like in Florida, have said that the president's close relationship with the governor there has helped them to get, originally they got 100% of their first two requests. Now, there are other states that don't have such a close relationship with the president, and they have not been able to get those expedited requests filled. Now, the president and the administration say that they've done a lot for democratically led states as well. There is a lot of concern that politics has infiltrated the disaster relief process, and states that are not as friendly to the president or do not have close relationships between the governor and the president have not been able to get their requests filled as quickly.
Yeah, there seems to be a lot of mistrust here. There's a FEMA official who told the Washington Post that some states are asking for more than they need. Have you found that to be the case?
It's really a matter of perspective. States are saying they're looking at their curves. They're looking at the models that show that there will be a dire need for this equipment in a matter of days and weeks, and they're trying to get ahead of it. The federal government says that they can move quickly, that there's no need for panic buying, that once the peak happens, that the federal government will surge this equipment to the states that need them the most. There's just been a lack of harmony between the states and the federal government on the best way to approach this process, and that's part of the reason why there's so much dissatisfaction and even desperation among these states to try to get the federal government to fulfill some of their requests before they think it's too late.
And just to clarify that, do the states have reason to distrust that FEMA will actually get them more equipment at the time that they need it?
Yeah, there's been a lot of distrust within this entire process, in part because the states have asked for things that they have not been able to get. In some cases, FEMA has sent things to warehouses in the middle of the night when the warehouses are closed. Sometimes FEMA has sent boxes without identifying what's in the boxes. We've had some states say that they are opening boxes not knowing what's in them. So there is a lot of distrust that when things get really bad, that FEMA and the federal government will not be in a position to quickly get the states what they need. And that's part of the reason why these states are asking for all of this material at this point, in part because they believe that the federal government will not be in a position when things are at their worst to provide this material.
Just one more question, Tolu. It's clear that a surge is coming to many states and very soon. Is this problem of accessing vital equipment like ventilators and personal protective gear getting any better?
Well, it's not really, in part because there just aren't the numbers of equipment that are needed to fill the requests. And so this is looking like it's getting worse before it gets better. The federal government does say that they have more equipment being built and manufactured, but it just doesn't seem like it's happening in fast enough time to get to the peak. And there's a lot of concern that things are going to be very bad over the next few weeks.
Washington Post White House reporter Tolu Olorunipa, thank you very much.
Thank you.
Here and Now is a production of NPR and WBUR in association with the BBC World Service. I'm Lisa Mullins.
I'm Jeremy Hobson. This is Here and Now.